Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we seek to recover faith by recovering the faith.
Yep.
And we're discussing Nathan's book, Essential Faith. We're discussing the exhortations at the end of the book. And I guess for two episodes now, we've been talking about this one exhortation, retool discipleship.
Yeah.
And we've talked about how God's tool of discipleship is the gospel. It's the cross. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to focus in on what it looks like to disciple in community. How do you disciple in community? The gospel creates a community. And in this community, we disciple one another. We make disciples.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems kind of obscure, I think, to a lot of people, and to myself included, I guess, but I've used this language for a long time, even before maybe I understood it at the level I do now. Right now, I say at the level I do right now because I'm sure that there's some, you know, there's a spectrum, and we're all hopefully moving in the right direction on it. So wherever I'm at, the previous one was, I talked a lot about the idea of like dying with Christ and stuff like that, right? I think anybody who's a serious disciple, as Red Watchman Nee, maybe, you know, we have that language. But it's difficult. I think a lot of us aspire to do this thing where we want to carry his cross. And we talked about that last time, where we want to be the hero. Remember mm-hmm. that?
Yeah.
But our cross is a lot less glamorous and a lot more mundane, right? It's those simple things day in and day out. So, you know, cross bearing may be a prolonged period of just anonymity, you know, a grind, an empty labor that seems to be going nowhere, can be bearing our cross. So you may not have this flash in the pan life like Jesus had, mm-hmm. right? But that doesn't mean that you are not following him or that you are less than in some way. And I think that that's what's maybe another important thing about what we've been saying from this book is that Christianity is much smaller, more portable than I think most people believe. And because of that, it is generalizable so that someone can be a fully realized Christian regardless of their life circumstances. Mm-hmm. So Paul makes the point that whatever circumstance you were called in, remain there. And I think that there was a drive, you know, among people who were slaves and they accepted the gospel and they think, now what? You know, just going right back to digging ditches or whatever it is, you know, harvesting the fields. And it seems again and again, all of the New Testament writers emphasize the importance of remaining in the station, but it was a qualitative switch. So a slave had their own cross. It was different from what Christ carried, and yet it was also the same. It is the tool through which God is making us like his son. Our circumstances, the difficulties, the opportunities for self-giving love, those times when I may be invited, and they're more frequent than we know if we would just look around, you know, if we would have less of an eye toward what I might be getting from life or where I'm going or what I hope to achieve or my regrets and dissatisfaction. And I can wake up through faith, really, I think, to the world, wider world, and discover that there are innumerable opportunities to accept God's will, his presence in my life in these moments of what many would call frustration. Mm-hmm. And yet those things that would be frustrations for those who are retaining this illusion of control and power for us become discipleship moments where we can relinquish this instance, mm-hmm. the next thing, you know, my agenda. All of that is the cross. And the thing that comes in the wake of that, I believe, those moments when I learn to defy this instinct of survival, control, whatever it is you may want to call it, and something unexpected, blessed happens in its wake as I'm committing that to God now. I think that's a resurrection moment. And so that is discipleship. I think when Jesus invites people, and I kind of made a big deal out of the fact that his earthly disciples didn't change. They didn't become any more like him by the end of their time with him than they were at the beginning. But when somebody goes through one of these, what I would call a revolution, you know, mm-hmm. Not an overturn of a government, but one...
Revolve revolution.
Right, one cycle, right? Mm-hmm. One complete cycle of die and rise. And so these are micro deaths, micro resurrections. But as someone audits those, as someone encounters them, and instead of resurrection becoming a proposition of a historical event, it becomes a daily reality, the idea of faith and trusting becomes less of a leap and more of just a step, mm-hmm. you know, more of an obvious next step for those who've done it. Mm-hmm. And so that's, in my mind, that's what discipleship looks like, right?
But and that's taking up your cross.
Exactly. And it is a very private, solitary thing. I can't make you do it. You can't make me do it. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we are called to make disciples, right? So how does one go about doing that when so much of the actual dynamics are this kind of mysterious working, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. That God really has to show up in that transaction for somebody to become a disciple, that mm-hmm. even the best teacher who's ever lived, and, you know, Jesus himself, can't actually make a disciple through words or example, apart from his example in terms of the cross, right? So how do we do that for one another? Mm-hmm. And I don't think I have this nailed down. And so if you have other ideas, you know, about how we can do it, I'm open to it. I had
but
some
you did
suggestions.
Have a few, yeah, you had some mm-hmm. suggestions in there.
Yes,
you know, two or three points mm-hmm. about making disciples in community.
Right.
What were they?
They are corporate worship, gospel rehearsal, and loving confrontation.
Corporate worship, gospel,
corporate prayer is actually
corporate
what I had.
Prayer. Mm-hmm. Okay, yep. Corporate prayer. Yeah. Gospel rehearsal, mm-hmm. loving confrontation.
Yeah.
Okay. Corporate prayer. Now, all right. So that's praying together.
Yes.
And as opposed to praying by myself, mm-hmm. and I'm going to need more than praying by myself. I'm going to need to get together with other Christians.
Yeah.
And when we get together, we really need to pray together.
Yeah.
We have a tendency to not, you know, you think like you attend a worship service. There are some prayers that get prayed, mm-hmm. but it's much more singing together and mm-hmm. listening to someone preach.
Right.
Not much praying together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and small groups, church small groups.
Sure.
You know, lots mm-hmm. of talking. Mm-hmm. And we might even have a prayer time, but lots more time is spent in prayer requests than in prayer.
Yeah.
And we have our little prayer group,
pray
and we
for
know
Betty
what that's
Lou, like. You know, she's been running around again, and bless her heart. Yeah.
And we have our little prayer group, and we've had to like set a timer on when the clock strikes this time, we got to start praying.
Right.
We got to give prayer its due.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we probably don't, but anyway, we give it some time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to me that was an instinct of the early church, and it's really where they began. Now, they didn't have the opportunity to get together for a Bible study because they didn't have printed copies of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So maybe they would have done more of that. It doesn't seem that they lamented that or that they attempted to fix it. You know, mm-hmm. it wasn't like... You know, and they left the synagogue and took with them the scrolls. You know? That would have been bad. Anyway, it seems that their instinct was to spend just a lot of time in prayer together. Mm-hmm. Jesus' really first command after his resurrection is sit down. Mm-hmm. You know, take the next 10 days and pray. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, people... We might lament times when God's not showing up or something, but it was like, when was the last time you were in a 10-day prayer meeting? Mm-hmm. You know, so until maybe you tried that, maybe don't complain because Jesus seemed to, and he didn't give them a time limit. He just said, wait, right? Mm-hmm. And that waiting isn't something inert. It's not like, you know, our sense of waiting is carry on about your life and something will, you know, you know, lambast you out of left field. That's mm-hmm. you know, that's what I, that's my preferred method of waiting. Mm-hmm. But waiting biblically seems to be much more like watching, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're a watchman on the wall, as it were, you know, you weren't really doing a whole lot other than keeping your eyes peeled. Mm-hmm. You were canceling other things and putting yourself in a place and time and to encounter something mm-hmm. that you anticipate. So, yeah, it's about investing time. Maybe that's the, you know, I've heard people say that if you want to see what someone believes in, look at their checking account, you know, mm-hmm. but maybe we should say, look at their day planner or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, if people had day planners, at any rate. And, you know, that's, I think that's convicting. I know it's convicting for me. I don't know for everybody else, mm-hmm. but yeah, if, I mean, think about what are the, you know, what are some of the implications of the gospel in terms of our access to God? Like, here you go.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, you have access now. Uh-huh. Jesus has opened the door. What are you going to do with that opportunity?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a good analogy here, you know, thinking of somebody who's, you know, super celebrity or something. Everybody wants to hang around and you just have a standing, you know, date for coffee with this person that everybody wants to be like and hang around, you mm-hmm. know. I'm realizing how out of tune I am with pop culture now, but if someone was important and people knew who it was.
Yeah. So we're supposed to say like Timothy Chalamet now.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you just got, you know, you got standing coffee with, I guess, Timothy Chalamet, if he's important to you. And maybe he's wanting to coach you in your acting career, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, I see something in you, and I think it's best if we just schedule something and, you know, we just both show up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you come for a few times, but then you're like, you know, I'm really busy, Tim. And, you know, after a while, you just, you know, you blow him off here and there. And, you know, what would that suggest, mm-hmm. you know? I think it's kind of ridiculous to think, here's somebody reaching down, you know. Mm-hmm. And Jesus depicts it as a king inviting people to a marriage feast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been invited to something. You know, you got a golden ticket, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if you think about the Willy Wonka movie, there's something I understand. It's from the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But people get this golden ticket, right? And everybody wants it. You know, Veruca Salt's dad's got people opening wrappers around the clock, right, to find it. And, you know, you can imagine somebody just stumbling into it, and Charlie Bucket sort of kid that just happens to get one bar and open it, you know, and it's on eBay. You know, I mean, what does Willy Wonka see there, you know? Yeah, I think that we probably should sit with that idea that you've been invited to a White House gala and we put it up on eBay. We trade, you know, something very vulgar, you know, for some great irreplaceable honor. But I think that the reason I say corporate prayer is sometimes it's hard for us to maybe peel out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And we get caught up. And that's how Jesus depicts the people who don't have time to go to the feast, right? Oh, I bought a field. I have to go see it. You know, there's just so much going on. It's so busy, right? And here's this once in a lifetime opportunity. Now, maybe we despise it because of familiarity, because of the ready access, you know, which is probably why we need to set up some occasions, appointments for people to meet and pray, for people to be maybe even held accountable to pray, in the sense that somebody's like, hey, you know, what's up? And that will get back to loving confrontation. But yeah, corporate prayer, at least in my life, has been a big deal. Prayer itself, I think, is the exercise of the gospel in the sense that, you know, if we really believe that you know, we have gotten the golden ticket. We will show up. But also showing up by yourself sometimes is harder. So having somebody else there. And I think corporate prayer gets more done, to be honest. You know, I think there's a degree of faith that is required to achieve some things. And I think that that faith somewhat, it can be. So you can either have one person with a lot of faith or a lot of people with a little faith.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think
let's pool our resources here.
Mm-hmm. I do think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that gets back to some of what Paul says when he says, you know, don't forget that everyone's been allocated a portion of faith
mm-hmm.
in Romans 12.
Mm-hmm.
So if we presume that we have 100% of what's needed, it's going to make us not want to participate in some sort of a corporate prayer gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe all of us presume that. Faith is something that's very difficult to quantify. We may hold on to a proposition, but the degree to which we believe it, trust, you know, how far are we willing to go with this? That can only be seen, I think, in our behavior. And here's where it really gets challenging, and in the divine response. So if you want a book that's going to, you know, wreck you, ruin your life, is With Christ in the School of Prayer by Andrew Murray. Talk about something old, right? Yeah, back when I was a kid in the 1850s. Andrew Murray was writing books. And With Christ in the School of Prayer was... it's a very challenging book because he says that... the proof that we've prayed properly is the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't say that, right? What are you saying? Everyone's going to quit your church, dude. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, it just calls to mind the teachings on prayer, those sort of radical statements about prayer that mm-hmm. with faith you'll have the answer. You
yeah.
know, you'll have it. You know?
Yeah.
You know, these... So it seems it's very challenging, but he seems to be tapping into something that is said by Jesus and the apostles in the New Testament.
Uh-huh. Not only tapping in, but really will not let go, nor let you come up with some sort of, you know, an interpretation to excuse uh-huh. Jesus for saying such a thing.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the way I think of his book is he's just kind of, you know, he's opened the Bible to one of those passages, and then he just grabs the back of your head and shoves your face in it, you know, and you're like, wait, you know, you're trying to turn and get a breath, and he just keeps, you know, until you'll finally just accept it. No, you know, Jesus did say that, and so where is it?
So he's calling us to, Andrew Murray is calling us to corporate prayer that doesn't quit until we see answers, mm-hmm. and we learn through the process of praying and not seeing answers, praying again and seeing answers. And we learn, mm-hmm. we go back and ask, what are we doing wrong? You know, how are we being misguided by our desires? And have we really submitted it over to God? And or have we not just, or do we just need to persevere? And mm-hmm. so he's calling for us to enter into a school of prayer, a life, yes. a learning process.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And I think, so Richard Foster, who also thinks With Christ in the School of Prayer is the best book on mm-hmm. prayer ever written, but decided to go ahead and write his own book on prayer.
Anyway. He wrote a good book on prayer.
Yeah, it's good. But he has a great analogy of the television where he says, you know, let's say that we've been told that there are, and there used to be signals out in the air. So let's say Wi-Fi, right? There's something going on and you can't see it. There's something to be experienced and heard and seen and everything, but, uh-huh. you know. It's in this room right now with me,
mm-hmm.
But I can't perceive it. And then someone gives you a device and says, okay, now you can begin to pick up these signals if you will, you know, open this device,
mm-hmm.
right? And you do. Now with him, it was a television and he was saying, so you turn it on and, you know, nothing happens. But you don't immediately go, I knew that whole thing about television waves was a lie. You know, but you know, he said, you try to figure out, you know, you still believe that they're, that these signals are out there. You can't see them. You believe that they're there, though. So you look around back. You know, you're troubleshooting. You're trying to figure out why is it, why am I not getting anything on my side? Because it's still there. It's it persists even though I'm not perceiving it at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so I have to persist. Mm-hmm. I see faith as largely like physical strength and the ability to do work, right? So the answer to prayer is the work. You know, it's the work in terms of not labor, but the accomplishment of a task through the application of energy. Okay. And so where does this energy come from? How are the tasks being carried out? And so I see faith as being the power or the strength to do the thing. But, and so if I go to do a thing and I discover that I'm unable, so my wife says, I need you to bring in the groceries, you know, and there's a box sitting there. I can't see what's in it, but, you know, I go to pick it up and I'm like, mm-hmm. you know, and it sits there. And, but I, you know, I don't immediately assume that there's something wrong with that task or that moving the box inside the house is impossible. Right. I just realized that this box is heavier than what I can lift. Mm-hmm. And so what do I do now? I could go to the gym, mm-hmm. you know, and spend the next, say, 6 months deadlifting mm-hmm. increasingly heavier weights and then go back. Mm-hmm. But by that time, the box, you know, all the food will have rotted. Mm-hmm. Right. So what else could I do? Now, you're wearing a conundrum here, Kent. What can I do? How can I get this box carried into my house?
Yeah, I'm going to have to get some help or get some tools to assist me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think it's very much like it because I think that there are people out there who are just, I mean, spiritual muscle men and they look exactly like the rest of us, mm-hmm. you know, but they have done the deadlifting. And I think that the private prayer that we do, where we are really prevailing with God, wrestling with God, as our name suggests, is Israel. And finding the wherewithal to prevail, to say, I won't let go unless you bless me, you mm-hmm. know. And sometimes God will, you know, he'll cripple us and, you know, we'll be in this this acute pain and want to let go. And yet it's the holding on where the blessing. You know, you let go of a second too early and you will not find it. Mm-hmm. So there is something about that prevailing in prayer, and I think it's why God withholds things that seem critically important. Maybe the more important, the more they're withheld, mm-hmm. Because of the need to prevail is so important, right? That it's not so much that God wants us to prove something to him, but that we only grow in our faith through the prevailing. And it's just like exercise, right? So, but if I don't right now, if I don't have time, which I should be taking the time, right? Jesus did. He took 40 days. So he could do things his disciples couldn't do. His disciples are like, why can't we do it? And he's like, you are a wimp. You haven't spent any time in the gym. I mean, that's really what he's saying.
Oh, you have little faith.
Right.
Or this kind comes out only by prayer.
By prayer.
Yeah.
And he doesn't mean you should have stopped and prayed longer right then. He's saying you do not have a history of prayer because he didn't stop then and pray. That would have been bad teaching, bad example to say it comes out only by prayer. But all you did was command it to leave. You know, he's saying, look, you're not rooted in prayer. You don't have that kind of background that I have of prevailing in prayer. Mm-hmm. So, but he invited them to have it, which is something that ought to, I think, challenge us. That really, if we can't do it, that Jesus only had one answer. He wasn't like, well, you know, just kind of sucks sometimes or whatever. So all that to say, yes, corporate prayer, I think, is important. And we started with the idea of how do we disciple one another. I do think that it's very powerful if someone with maybe a greater history, more experience in prayer can invite someone along. Mm-hmm. And that maybe many of us can pray together, you know. And I think in Acts 12 of the example of Peter being put in prison, here you have a very young church, right? and Peter's arrested. This seems almost like the nail in the coffin for this movement before it's even gotten done. You know, James has been martyred. I mean, this is getting real here. Mm-hmm. Peter's in prison. He's probably not going to last much longer. And there's a prayer meeting that's called. I don't know how many people were there, but there's obviously several. And it's obviously in a house that's of some means, because we know the architecture of it, that there was an inner house and an outer house, you know, that everyone's in. So in kind of Roman architecture, you had most of the house was almost public space. Okay. And so you had an outer gate. It was almost like a city wall. So you have an outer gate that's closed at night, but during the day it's open and people wander in and out. And then you have an inner house that is private, and that's, you know, you only come in there by invitation or whatever, okay? So we know that the house where they're meeting has both those layers. So it's not some little hut or whatever, right? We know that they had a household servant because she's named, okay? So it's people of some means. And they are hosting this prayer meeting in response to Peter being put in prison, okay? So they're all there praying, and an angel comes and lets Peter out of prison, right? Everyone's surprised. This doesn't happen every day. Mm-hmm. And the guy, you know, like a really bad Uber driver, just drops him off, you know, up the street and keeps going. And so Peter makes his way over to this house. Apparently, it must have been where they were meeting regularly, since he knew where to go. And he's pounding on this outer door. Now everyone's praying inside. They send Rhoda out because she's the servant. And she goes... Now, you didn't have a peephole or, you know, security cameras. You go, who is it? Right. And so she hears Peter on the other side of the door. He's like, it's Peter, let me in, you know. And she's like, and so she's taken aback enough that she runs back inside. She says, hey, someone's at the door. They say they're Peter, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's him. And I love that the unanimous response is, it's not him. He's in prison.
We're praying right, yeah. for his release. But we know it's not going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It must be his angel, they say. And maybe they mean messenger, since we get angel all out of whack mm-hmm. with messenger. But, you know, maybe he sent somebody. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it is some divine being or something that they thought. But whoever it is, it's not Peter. Now, finally, he bangs on it long enough. They're like, just find out who it is, you know. And, you know, it is him, and they take him in and all that. So I think those people's faith, number one, was lacking at the beginning. And afterward, probably went up a notch.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Of what they might expect God to do.
Yeah.
You know. So, and I think that happens a lot. In 1 John, there's this kind of this process where it's like, you know, if our heart condemns us, what is it that I'll just have to find it, that he's greater than our heart and he mm-hmm. knows all things. Mm-hmm. If our heart doesn't condemn us, then we get what we ask for, you know, and so there's this kind of cyclical and upwardly exponential kind of a movement to praying. So it kind of goes like this. He says, by this we know that we are of the truth and will reassure, I love that's in there, you know, our heart before him. Why? He says, right ahead of that, little children, let us not love in word or in talk, but in deed and in truth. Okay, so the cross really is, and I'm just going to keep backing up until I get all the way. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters, right? Mm-hmm. So here's this invitation to the cross, okay? But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or in talk, but in deed and in truth. So we're being called to actually do something with this. And this is this discipleship moment where I'm being given the opportunity to give something I have that you don't. And there are times, especially, you know, we, unfortunately, in well-to-do societies, affluent societies like ours, we don't get many opportunities to give something that represents our security.
Mm-hmm.
But any time, you know, somebody who is perhaps of a lower income, a laborer or a slave, is giving something away in those days, it may have been their livelihood, especially for the next day,
mm-hmm.
right? So he says, that, you know, do this in deed and in truth. That here we have something that is, it really begins with words. And the response is a very interior, subjective response. And so this faith is very subjective. And John is suggesting that if it stays that way, it's going to, it will stagnate and eventually wither. Okay, that this subjective thing is based on an objective reality. It's based on historical events. And those historical events must be the result of this message. So the message of the gospel encodes actions. A God who is not satisfied to just tell us that he loves us, but a God who has gone to a lot of trouble to become a human, demonstrate his love. And then the message of that now has become words, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those words encode and then they encapsulate the means of providing that love, this kind of faith and everything else, okay? And so he's saying, let's not keep this as words. Let's do something about it. And that thing we're supposed to do is we're supposed to radically love, or at least to love on demand, right? And to love in a way that meets the need, not just some way that satisfies our own itch to give at least something,
mm-hmm.
okay? So that's a lot more ad hoc. It's a lot more radical, you know, that the call on me to give is remains until my spiritual sibling is cared for,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that can be a difficult thing, okay? But by this... So now we're returning to our interior life, right? By this love, by this action of love, we will reassure our hearts before him. Mm-hmm. For whenever our heart condemns us, and I think most people who care about their relationship with God wonder, did I do enough? And, well, oh, was that wrong or whatever, right? He says, God is greater than our heart, and he knows everything. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. Okay, this is this kind of faith that we're being given, we're being called to. And whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do what pleases him. And this is his commandment. Now, it would be very cruel if he says, whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do what pleases him. And by commandments, I mean everything written in Matthew through Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would be very cruel because none of us would ever know that we've kept them all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but then he goes on to give us exactly what those commandments are. This is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his son, Jesus Christ, and love one another, period, exclamation point.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Okay, and so whoever keeps his commandments abides in God and God in him. And by this, we know that he abides in us by the Spirit whom he has given us. So you see this dynamic, this interplay of choosing to love reassures our hearts. With hearts reassured, we ask in confidence. Asking in confidence, we receive what we've asked for. Receiving what we ask for, we gain greater confidence, you know? So that there's this building of our faith through this loving action, okay? But prayer is woven in. It's woven into John 15 about, you know, John 15, abide in me, right? And so we get this call to abide in Christ. And he says, and if you abide in me, ask what you will, and it will be given to you, right? What does abiding in him mean? What is it like? It is this loving action. So what I'm suggesting is that discipleship is this pray, love, give, you know, pray, receive. You know, and then give, right?
So I hear you saying there's this call to the a life that imitates Christ,
mm-hmm.
in self-giving love, and we as we are living that life, we are the kind of people whose prayers get answered because mm-hmm. we are living in accordance with his will, and we're asking in accordance with his will.
Yeah.
And so there's the life we're living in it's in coordination with the prayers we're praying mm-hmm. and our, and the, they strengthen one another.
Right. Right. So I think love leaves a material vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're going to need to pray.
Exactly. So I need my brother to create the material vacuum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I need him to come and pray with me to fill that vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we're really all called to minister whatever's in our hand. And ministers are people who do not consider those things their own, but see them as something to dispense. But that you can only do your job if that item is going to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you give out all the pez, eventually you're just an empty piece of plastic, right? Mm-hmm. Unless somebody's there to put more pez in, right? Mm-hmm. So you're only a pez dispenser so long as someone's putting candy in you.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, you're just a piece of plastic. So I think that some people set out to give and to love out of this hero ideal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because of that, there is a reluctance to ask. But I think that one who has faith is ready to engage in, to wade in way over their head because they know that it's not really dependent on what they currently have access to,
mm-hmm.
but that their capacity will expand as the need continues. So, you know, and someone like a Mother Teresa, I think, understood this somewhat in that she had decided to not retain anything past the end of a day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's somebody who gets this daily bread kind of an idea that just if it comes in, it's here to give out. So I think a lot of us would do well, and I think that I don't think God begrudges us our 401ks and our savings accounts and things like that. I do think that we are potentially paying a price for those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a choice that we have to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how wealthy do we want to be? And so some of us choose relative poverty by retaining physical security.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if we're going to influence one another, then it is about we as a group modeling and encouraging and assisting each other to ask for things that maybe are over our heads. You know, when we go together and we bring our faith into one place and we see things being done.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that some of that corporate prayer, I said corporate worship, but you know, that means the whole thing. But yes, in this case, I do mean corporate worship. Now we're going to get into Adore Christ as One Flesh, where I kind of recalibrate what worship is. But the idea of getting together and singing songs to God is not a bad idea. You know, now it's not everything, but I do think that it is happening in heaven and should happen here. I do think that it is the Holy Spirit's native environment. So here's an analogy, and it's totally free of charge. I've shared it with some people, I think recently, I can't remember, but, so here's how I see it. Here's how I, experience prayer and times of just sincere and protracted worship together as a community. Here's what's been my experience with it. Okay. And that is like E.T.
E.T. E.T. Extraterrestrial.
Yes. So E.T. shows up and he's not from around here, right? He's not super, what would you say, survival ready. You know, he's not very adept, but he has some upgrades. He has some abilities, right? He's got this light that's glowing inside of him and he can move stuff around. He can do stuff that ordinary biological entities can't do, right? Mm-hmm. But he just has one thing he wants, right? You remember what it is?
He wants to go home, right? Phone home.
So there's an alien, and with that alien presence comes some maybe persecution, and also some experience, some unique experiences. Okay. And all that alien presence really wants is to phone home. Okay. Now, after a prolonged period of time of not being able to phone home, he inexplicably ends up all gray laying in a drainage swale, right? As he's isolated from his people, his community. Now, we think he's dead and he's just right there, right? But, you know, inexplicably again, he begins to revive, and now he's that much more urgent about the need to phone home, right? Mm-hmm. And, but he, you know, he's powered up. Maybe he's even more powered than he was as the mothership is approaching. And there seems to be something about that. This entity's strength is related to his connection with his native environment,
mm-hmm.
and his, community. So I think that's the Holy Spirit. You know, I think the Holy Spirit is a gentle, benign, alien presence that lives within people, and it has a desire to interact. Right? It is because he's alien. He's alienated, and it's a great sacrifice, I think, to be within us. Okay. But his purpose is to bring heaven here, so he's got to do it, right? And so he's here, and he's crying out from within us, Abba, Father, phone home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that, when that cry goes frustrated, ignored, suppressed, I think that the Spirit gets quieter. You know, I don't think he's vulnerable to us, but our experience of him is much, very much like him being in, you know, gray in a drainage swale. The Spirit fused to my spirit becomes that way. But when we spend time in the Spirit's native environment, so in Ephesians 5, we're told, you know, don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And then he goes into this litany of behaviors, right? Together, we're supposed to sing to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, praying and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that are normal for the Holy Spirit. All the rest of this stuff is alien and maybe somewhat caustic if we just give into it, you know, into a reactionary world of fear, survival, worry, regret. Those things begin to drive us. Then the Spirit begins to retreat,